Pacific Conversations from the Development Policy Centre with Tess Newton-Kane.
Welcome to Pacific Conversations. My name is Tess Newton-Kane, and this morning I'm very pleased to be able to have a cup of coffee and a chat with Fair Tevi. So, Fair, welcome to Pacific Conversations.
Thank you.
Okay, so maybe you could start by telling us a bit about yourself and your background, where you currently sit in the Pacific development space, and how you got here.
Okay, thanks, Tess. I'm married to Lenny, and we have five children. And Lenny has taken up a position at the Melanesian Spearhead Group, and so we have since January we moved in and basically set up home here, although I shuttled both in and out of Suva and other places doing work. Because of that, I had to leave a position in Suva at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, having done that since 2012, been the coordinator of the Green Growth Program, basically nurturing a coalition of leaders around the issue of growth and green blue growth around there and sustainable development. Since then, I've been working with Vanuatu government, the Solomon Islands government in particular, on the issue of sustainable development, on the issue of World Heritage Sites, and more focused on macro policy development, looking at national development plans, looking at overall macro policies like the ocean policy, looking at how political issues as well, and seeing how issues like the issue of West Papua shapes and reshapes the region,
yeah,
and seeing how that features in and amongst the politics of the day. Having said that, it's a transition. You think that you'd be a house husband and take care of the kids, and it's a very interesting place to be, and a position to be in. There are lots of things up in the future, and it looks good. It feels good. Yes, it feels good. So, in terms of development, studied in Paris, undergrad in the US, did my two masters in Paris at the University of Paris 11, Paris 11, and so, and also with the International Institute for Public Administration, which is it focuses on building the capacities of French bureaucrats going overseas to the colonies, sort of like a École Nationale d'Administration. It is actually the École Nationale d'Administration side of the international bureaucrats for France. So we did that. I am trained in diplomacy and international relations. Worked for the churches for a number of years, almost over a decade, both in Geneva, Switzerland, and also here in the Pacific. And therein lies prior to that, I was with the Pacific Concerns Resource Center, which is the it's the secretariat to the Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Movement. Very formative years, 96 to 2000, 97 to 2000. Formative years in terms of shaping the mindset,
yeah,
and shaping the perspectives on the region and how that flows out and carries on in the region. So that's my background. I am an Anglican, and so I also work very closely with the Anglican Church here in Vanuatu. I go to Seaside Anglican Parish, and that keeps my feet on the ground.
Well, I think that's given us a really good introduction that I've learned a lot about you that I didn't already know. And I think, you've raised a couple of things that we can discuss further.
Sure, sure.
I guess, first of all, I know earlier this year you were at the Pacific Islands Development Forum in Suva, and you were also in Port Moresby around the meeting of the Pacific Islands Forum. So, and this, I know this is something that you and I have discussed previously, but I'd be keen to know, based on your observations most recently, what do you think are the relative strengths and weaknesses of those organisations within the region?
I think that let's take PIFS first, and then we can look at PIF later. In terms of the forum, I think we're still seeing Dame Meg's input into the Pacific Islands Forum. The recent reminder to Papua New Guinea is an interesting one on the issue of West Papua. And I know for one that West Papua will determine the forum's ability or lack of to be and continue to be, or to develop into a new, or what is, or what used to be, their political clout.
So why is that? Because for a long time the forum had nothing to say about West Papua, certainly not publicly. We know that it was being discussed in the sidelines, but so what is it that you feel has changed that makes West Papua such an important issue for the future?
I think part and parcel, the most influential here is social media. I think that there is a step up in awareness on the issue of West Papua.
Yeah.
And you asked the question before about the issues of development. One thing that I failed to also add is my links with the Pacific Advocacy Network on Globalization. I chair that organization, and it has also influenced the way I also look at matters around the region. And so one of the issues is the whole discussion on West Papua, and social media has had a lot of influence in bringing that issue to the table, not only of the governments, but also churches, NGOs, civil society organizations, women's groups, youth groups. It has placed West Papua almost at the core of any type of identity that the Pacific will have to grapple with in the future. And we cannot ignore West Papua.
It's quite interesting from the Vanuatu perspective, because obviously previously Vanuatu was very much at the heart of that voice for West Papua, having the government in exile or however they want to describe themselves.
Yes.
And then I think I'd agree that in the last, really in the last 18 months, two years, we've seen other countries step up, largely via civil society, through social media. I was in Canberra a few years ago where somebody said, oh yeah, West Papua was a non-issue, and I remember thinking, well, not in my country. And I think, we've seen that voice spread and rise in other places. Even in places where it was being kept very quiet, like Fiji.
Yeah, I think that you have the opportunity here to begin to see how movements move, movements take shape in the region. Vanuatu's leadership has been instrumental in keeping the issue of West Papua on the agenda, but it has had its limits. We've always spoken about the need to leverage and to increase the profile of West Papua, but we haven't quite shifted or taken the next step in terms of, okay, what else? Right? What else is there to do? And so this is where Solomon Islands initiative to create a position within its foreign ministry and within the Prime Minister's office, specifically on West Papua, has given us the opportunity to begin to focus strategically on West Papua, together with everybody around the table, to say, where do we take this issue from here over the next 5 years, next 10 years? What are the key strategies that we put in place to ensure that West Papua remains an issue for the forum, but also for the other areas? And so this is why I'm saying, forum itself, this will be the determining factor. How they treat West Papua and how they are able to get the political support around the issue. And you do, it won't go away. It won't go away. It's interesting to see how regional politics is playing out. You and I might want to have some cover over Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and the issue of West Papua over the recent years, over the recent days, last week, this week.
I agree that it's not going to go away. I also think there's still a long way to go. Significant strides have been made, significant things have been achieved, but this is not a done deal. There's still an awful long way to go, and people are, I think, no matter where you stand on the issue, the fact is that there's going to be a lot of patience needed to get this across the line.
And we will need to be strategic about that input. We can no longer afford to just be emotional about it. Indonesia is not emotional.
No.
Indonesia is very strategic and objective about the issue of West Papua, and so should we.
Yeah.
Getting back to the issue of the forum. So, as I said, Dame Meg is doing awesome work. What we need to see is the results that need to begin to flow. So she's been in there for about a year. So we'll now begin to see the results of her influence in terms of shifting an organization that is bureaucratically cumbersome to something that is nimble and flexible, and flexible enough to do that. Also, the issue in terms of the forum, seeing how Australia and New Zealand will play out their pressure and their role in the new forum that's in the making. That will also decide how the Pacific Island countries will take the forum. Now that the option is there, because before there was no option, and I would love that the IDF takes all the credit for COP21. And all the focus by international countries on 1.5, or at least to get there, and the coalition of the ambitious and nations and all. But I think PIDF had a role to play in harnessing the collective momentum of the countries to stand together and say, yes, this is what we need, and not to be pulled apart. So that was, I think for me, that the month of September was an interesting month, where you had one meeting after the other, and people saying same things, and then coming right through, and holding their stance at the forum, saying this is what we thought, and this is what you get. Despite all the pressures, checkbook diplomacy, everything was up to try and get the Pacific Island countries to shift and take positions. And so, kudos to them.
Yes.
Kudos to Honorable De Broome for his excellent initiative. So you see that coming through, and you see, and now I shift to PIDF. You see that new momentum taking place, and I think PIDF expresses that in a much more comprehensive way than the Pacific Islands Forum. It is a momentum that is inclusive, an organization that is inclusive, that brings the civil society and the private sector in onto the table, make them sit around the table and decide together what are the key issues and challenges that the region will be facing and how to address them together. And I think that's the way, for me, that would be one of the strengths that we can give to the Pacific Islands Development Forum.
It won't surprise us to know that I remain somewhat skeptical about the future role of the IDF. And I think the main reason that I do have my questions about is that, you know, there are significant Pacific players, PNG, Vanuatu, who have yet to really come aboard with the whole PIDF model or the PIDF approach. And one of the things that I think is an issue, particularly for Vanuatu, is that Indonesia is in there supporting PIDF, putting money into it. And is there not, like, an inherent tension there?
Right. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And I think I think how it will play out is this, is as we move, as PIDF develops as an organization, what we will hopefully see is Fiji stepping back from taking leadership in the PIDF and getting the PIDF to be a more regional organization as it stands. The only reason, the main reason why it has become political is because Fiji has taken that step to do that, and to be political about it. I think the IDF is big enough to have both Indonesia and West Papua roaming around and then doing their thing around. And it's not created to be a political entity, although people may think that it is one. I think the and this is again another one of the strengths, is that the IDF is created to be flexible enough, nimble enough to respond to the sustainable development challenges of the region. How we use it and what we use it for, as you know, there's a lot of corridor discussion, a lot of receptions and a lot of things, and so people will have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't think we should qualify the IDF and the future of the IDF based on what happened at the recent PIDF meeting in Fiji with regards to Indonesia and also the issue of West Papua.
Well, again, I think there's more to come on
both sides
of that story, and there'll be more to talk about. Certainly, yeah. I would agree that some of the changes we've seen in the way that the Pacific Islands Forum is engaging with civil society and with the private sector can largely be attributed to the PIDF stance on that. The PIFs has looked at that and thought, oh, well, you know, we could do more of that as well. So, I mean, and that, I think, is a good thing.
I think one thing, Tess, is one of the big challenges with regards to PIDF is the challenge of falling into being a prop agency. It's a big slippery slope, and basically it's because maybe, you know, that's all that we know how to do. I mean, that's how we deal with regional issues. Is that, you know, we have the crop approach, the crop agencies approach. It becomes cumbersome, and that's the real threat for PIDF, is that PIDF falls into that states where it sees itself as a regional body, and then it starts to act like one, and then it starts to put, you know, fences and barriers and everything, and that's not the character and identity that PIDF should be.
I think that's right, and you know, I think, you know, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I guess there's a fine line, because you've got to have a certain amount of structure and governance lines and all that in order to be able to get stuff done, you know. Otherwise, it's, you know, if it's going to be more than just everyone gets together once a year and has a conversation and it's all very free and easy and nice, that's fine. But if you want to actually deliver something more tangible, there needs to be a certain amount of structure in order for that to happen.
Yeah, and PIDF is not... PIDF was not set up to do the crop work.
Right.
PIDF was not set up to do that. And this is where we need to be, or we need to have clarity on what PIDF is. It's a space. Maintaining that space is a very difficult challenge because everybody wants to cloud that space in, Fiji included. Everybody wants to get that space, monopolize that space. As long as we can keep that space as an opportunity for people to come and talk about issues of challenges, talk about opportunities, discuss, deal, you know, that will form the character of PIDF. It's not a crop agency. It will not deliver on water tanks and eyewash problems. No. It's not geared towards that.
No, it's not a development agency.
No, and we should keep it as such. Because once we move down the slope of projects, that's it.
That's
we've
right.
lost the essence of what PIDF should be looking at.
Well, I think that's a really important point, and one that I don't think has necessarily been articulated completely explicitly up to now. So I think it's really important that point is made and that message is maintained, and that's what the idea is for, and it's not to do those other things.
I think we desperately it's an everyday challenge for PIDF, and good luck on the new SG, on the new DG, because that space is a prime, like we call it, real estate. It's a prime location, because we've placed it.
And it's a contested space.
Yes.
And there are so many relationships to manage, and the internal relationships are possibly more problematic or more difficult to manage than some of the external relationships. I mean, it's as you say, there's a lot to do, and just managing that space is going to be. I want to move on to discuss your work or your thinking around green growth and sustainable development, which you said you've been working on quite extensively. I was chatting with Ben Sims at the Global Green Growth Institute the other week, and he made the point to me that globally, green growth has yet to really be pinned down in terms of what it means as a concept, different people conceptualising it in different ways. So I guess I'd really like to start with that, is how do you conceptualise it? How do you see it? How does it apply in the Pacific? Because I know it exists as a concept elsewhere, but within the Pacific context, what does green growth mean?
Yes. We've thought since 2011, we've thought about this issue of green growth, what it means, what it does not mean. What it does not mean solely is the Korean approach to defining green growth. It's not just technology. So I would say for the region, for the Pacific region, it's not just about a technological perspective on growth, on greening growth. It's not just that, as what Korea would claim or would be pushing for. The Green Growth Institute, Global Green Growth Institute, is also an interesting body that tries to grapple with the integrated framework on green growth. It still has its challenges in terms of defining what green growth will mean, especially with regards to the new sustainable development goals. How does green growth fit? Where it fits? What is GGGI's role in that new framework? In the work that we've been doing over the last 3-4 years in the Pacific, green growth has to do with lifestyles. Green growth has to do with a sustainable approach to development. Green growth has to do with the maturity of the countries to determine where and how they want to address development. So there's a positive and strong collaboration that we in the Pacific would place between green growth and sustainable development. It sticks. Right? or maybe green growth, sustainable development, and political maturity. Right? So you keep on adding to the, you know, and then it becomes a ladder, or you begin to weave that mat that we said. And so far that's how we look at things. That's how green growth can be defined nowadays. It's about sustainable development. It's about looking at issues that are user-friendly. It's about looking at our environment and seeing how we can adapt our environment or adapt ourselves to the environment that is coming or that is there. It's about political maturity. It's about the ability of Pacific Island countries to determine their own future. And so green growth cannot be solely restricted to an academic exercise of defining what it is and what it is not. Green growth is more than just that. It's a more holistic approach to a lifestyle. We've gone about the region and we've gone about saying that in order to address green growth, in order to address the economic and environment challenges that we have, we need to change our lifestyles. But change it to what? The question that always has come back to us is, okay, of course, change it. Yes, good. But change it to what? You know, do you want us to go back to being grass skirts, wearing grass skirts and doing that? Of course, I say no. But I would also add to that the solution does not lie outside the region. It's right inside the region. How we reconfigure ourselves, how we look at our lifestyles, our traditional cultural lifestyles, to then begin to create this type of a society that lives within its means, that has a set of core values. That's green growth. And it's something that's in the making. It's not, and of course it will be defined in the future. People will come and will add to it. You know, and it will continue to be defined as we move along. But as of, I think, today, this day and age today, this is how we can define it.
So, can you give me any examples of what sort of practical impact a concept like green growth, which you've said is very much tied in with sustainable development, what's a practical example of how that can add to or change the way that Pacific Island countries do business?
Good example of this: tropical cyclone Tam. Okay. You were here, I was here.
I was here, actually. I was in Fiji. I got back very soon after.
I was here. You went through the whole situation. We went through how this community of Vanuatu, civic community of Vanuatu, was able to go through the cycle, sit back for a day, take a breather, and then the very next day start off again, rebuilding, but not waiting for assistance to come in. It was the very next day you could see people started to pick up the pieces and move on. A lot has been written about the resilience of the Vanuatu people. And we can look around the region and we can see examples, time and time again, of the resilient nature of the Pacific Islanders. Not having gone through AusAid courses and DFAT courses and Red Cross workshops and et cetera, on resilience. But our very own understanding of how we live within our means and in our environment. And that has now, as a result of Cyclone Tam, people are beginning to look more closely at how resilience expresses itself in an indigenous local community. Before, it was almost like a weakness. You know, they would say, oh, they look at it, or, you know, you look at the thatching, you look at the houses, you look at, oh, that's not cyclone proof. But guess what? When the cyclone goes through, what is the first house to come back up? It's the traditional house. So let's define resilience again. Is it to withstand the cyclone, or is it to recover quickly and then move on? Right? working within the means, working within our nature. So,
but is that growth or is
no,
that recovery?
No, no, hold on, hold on. That's, that for me expresses a set of values that for me green growth encompasses.
Okay.
Right? That for me expresses a set of values that green growth encompasses. And that's part of, I guess, a sense of maturity that, that we're going through. The recognition that there is something that we can learn. And that the future of the region, in terms of growth, it's not by outside, it's within us.
Yeah.
It's here. And we need to find the tools to identify those issues and to identify those strengths and components of what we can call good growth in the future. So that's one example. I mean, we can quote here. We quote Nuclei Line Tuvalu, another can't remember the village in Ra in Fiji. You know, examples of which Hapai, Pangai, for example, you know, examples of which time and time again the resilient nature of these communities has expressed itself. With or without, even without foreign assistance. So we need to think about that. We need to think how that defines and how that defines growth for us in the future.
And also how that then forms a platform for what comes next.
Exactly.
So then it's exactly. Not just, so it goes beyond simply what recovery, but then it goes things, those strengths are continued into development of whatever type.
Exactly.
As you say, that fits with it's environmentally appropriate in our means. But you know, so I think that's what's been missing previously. Is it's like, oh yeah, that's all very well for recovery, but then we stop doing that and we do something else. Well, maybe no, we need to work out how do we continue that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and then you know, there's been a lot of complaints about how Vanuatu, you know, manage the humanitarian aid partners and agencies. And kudos to them, you know, to be able to tell them off and say, hey, this is how we do things in this country. We might be slow, we might be this, but this is how it is. And so this is how we work. You know, if you wanna do something, please go to another disaster. But this is how we manage our disaster. And I think that sends a good signal, and I think we should be learning from that. And
well, I mean, I've observed what happened here from close in and then from further away. You know, what it really brought home to me is all those issues about development that we talk about. You know, when something like Secoplan happens, there are no new issues. It's all the same issues, just really, really large. It's like, you know your context, use your local knowledge. It's all about the relationships, managing all of those things. They're not new. Like, it's just that when something like that happens, it just makes it really, really clear how important they are. So I think there is an awful lot to learn and a lot of really valuable skills that were learned in a very short space of time that we now need to be able to capitalize on and grow and embed into everyday business. So it's not something we just save up for special occasions.
No.
This is the way we do things every day.
Yes, look at how the communities got together. Right? Look at how the communities got together without foreign assistance. How they got together and dealt with the issue without foreign assistance.
Look at how the private sector just got on and looked after their staff and looked after their clients.
Exactly.
That's
how we need to, and we need to integrate all those things into this bigger picture.
Yeah.
Try and begin to take those examples and those learnings,
yeah,
and then weave it in as we move along.
Yeah.
I come back to the initial question. It is about doing good, and that's a component of it, an example of how we do and how we can change things.
Yeah.
And so it is a long road.
Yeah, it's a long game.
Just like West Papua. It's going to be a long-term issue. Right.
This is not a three-year project.
No.
Okay, so when you told us about your background, obviously you have a very strong background in civil society coming from the church's side of things and other NGOs. So how would you assess the capacity of civil society in the region at the moment to influence the sorts of important debates and decision-making we've been talking about?
Interesting question, Tess. I had a recent discussion about the word activism and how activism has changed over the last 15, 20 years. Back in the days when countries in the Pacific just reached and got their independence, activism was high. Political activism was there. There was a lot of issues, a lot of concerns, and Vanuatu being one of the countries that came out of that era, Fiji in the 70s, starting of that era, and so we had that type of political activism that was ripe and that was there. But then we went through, it was like a lull, late 80s into the 90s when activism was beginning to be institutionalized. And then when we began to institutionalize activism, then we began to lose the edge of cutting edge of it. And I think this is, I guess, this, it's a normal development of any movement that wants to begin to coordinate itself and bring up a secretariat, and after a while becomes a bureaucracy, then it turns into an institution, and then you lose the edge. Then, interestingly enough, activism has come back in a new way. Since 2008, 2009, since Copenhagen, where you see this activism or this new type of activism coming through in the region, right? I'm not talking about international, I'm talking about just the region. And so we see activism being defined, redefined again. And here again, I come back to the issue of West Papua. West Papua is redefining political activism in the region. You look at just what happened in Paris at COP21, where you have the new activists, you have the new environmental activists that are coming through, the Young Soul Warriors, Young Soul Warrior Movement, Young One Soul Warrior Movement, the One Soul Warrior Movement, the other groups that have ICANN or PCAN, the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network. These are all young, new activists that are coming through. They've gone through the USB channels, and now they're out, and now they want to change the world. Right? All good. But that's what we see, is this sense of new sense of dynamism or in civil society. What the old horses like a lot of us around the table, when we look at the new civil society movements, we often say, it would have been good that they acknowledge their place and position within the globe, within the broader strand of a movement, and recognize those who have contributed in the past. And also bring them along. It seems like our young activists are a little bit too keen on stamping their mark, that they fail to see that there has been a history of activism up to date. And so that's where I see activism and civil society now, a big blossoming of it coming through. But also new cutting-edge trends, like, for example, the whole discussion around sustainable shipping and sustainable sea transport is coming back to the fore, and that's using traditional maritime skills to address what is a key regional environmental challenge. Pollution, maritime pollution. Right? So you have that type of, and you have the Pacific Voyaging Trust and the Voyager Society, one of which, you know, the canoe, one of the vakas is right here outside in front of the waterfront. Those are the new expressions of civil society that's coming through. Creations of these types of movements or organizations that are beginning to tackle bigger issues. Of course, they're saying, well, we just want to address sustainable shipping in traditional skills and maintain traditional skills. But what they're also doing is addressing the issue of, you know, we can replicate the effects from maintaining navigational skills, traditional navigation skills, all the way up to advocating for bunker fuels, right? For the decrease in bunker fuels that the International Maritime Organization wanted. You know, that's the link.
Yeah.
And Vanuatu being a flag state has influence and critical decisions to make.
But isn't that where there's a weakness in these linkages? Because from what I see, I don't see civil society here in Vanuatu engaging with government, either in dialogue or in activism to influence national policy. I don't see an awful lot of that. I see some token consultations, but I don't see articles in the paper from NGOs saying this is what we want in terms of this particular policy. And to go back to Cyclone Man, one of the things that it highlighted to me was that although there were some relationships between NGOs and some government departments, overall, NGOs really have very weak links with government, even just in knowing who to pick up the phone and talk to about issues. And I think that possibly contributed to some of the apparent disconnect between government response and humanitarian response.
And I think we cannot point five of our fingers at civil society. I think there's a lot of responsibility also that governments have to take on in terms of how they deal with civil society. The civil service, there has to be a revisiting of what civil servants mean and being a civil servant. You are a servant of the government. You are a servant of the government by means is the people.
Mm-hmm.
So you serve the people. It's not the other way around. You know, people don't come in and on their knees to come and ask for service. No, they should, as citizens, rightfully ask and request that assistance from you and that service from you. I think there needs to be a give and take in this discussion.
Absolutely.
Civil society, yes, we have a responsibility, but also governments will have to change because we can no longer function. And I come back to the whole idea of discussion of inclusivity. Government needs to recognize that civil society has a role to play.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
Similarly
with the private sector, civil society needs to recognize that the private sector has a role to play in government.
Right.
So, I mean, that's something that I spend quite a bit of time worrying about or thinking about is, you know, we live in countries with small resource sets, you know, wouldn't it be better if we all just work together? And there are opportunities to work together without compromising our ideals or it becoming corrupt and messy. It can be done in a meaningful, positive way. And I think, you know, there are a lot of wasted opportunities because people just can't find a way to sit down and talk to each other.
I think the faster governments give that space, step back and create that space for people to come in and work for them, the better our countries will be in the future, but not included.
I think there's a lot to it. Okay, so my last question is in relation to your home country of Tonga. How significant do you think is the recent election of Akhilesi Kohinga for democracy in Tonga?
Good question. I think in the longer run, in the medium to long term, I think there is a lot of benefit that can accrue from Akhilesi and his time and his government being in place. I think there's a lot of lessons that can be taken from the first year or so of Akhilesi's government. A lot of questionable decisions. I think there's been a lot of decisions with regards to positions. Maybe a number of the positions have been given as thank you gifts for support. I think we cannot deny that. It's blatant, almost to the point of kicking you in the face.
Yes.
In terms of quality of the person, qualifications versus position, and the role. But in the bigger picture, I think there is a lot of lessons we can learn. And there is more good than, there is more strength than weaknesses that's coming out of this government. The fact that, Tonga has taken a strong stance on the issue of West Papua is a token of that. And you will see this government taking on regional issues in a much more stronger way than in the past. First year has been about consolidating and shifting the country at the national level. I think you will see Tonga playing a more influential role in the region in the future. Now that Tonga is now the chair of PCIDS in New York, so that's another influential issue. That's an issue about PIDF as well. The strength of having and being the connection between New York and the Pacific. Pacific Small Island Development States, PCIDS discussion, and the definition of that vis-a-vis the region. That's another big issue that could influence the region picture in the future. And we've seen it happen.
Yeah.
And we've seen COP as a result. We've seen the UNGA as a result. And you see the PCIDS working in the background to getting that type of platform. So Tonga being the chair of it for the next couple of years, it's going to be an interesting time for Tonga and an interesting time for the region from Tonga's perspective as well. So,
looking forward to it. Look forward to.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time and sharing your thinking with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you
for the opportunity.
Yes. Thank you, Tess.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.